Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Friends, there's been a small break in this podcast, as you might have noticed, but I'm back now with a sort of new episode. I say sort of because it's a crossover episode with another podcast, which is called The Breakup Theory, hosted by Shuli Branson. You might remember Shuli from episode 228 of this show. They're the author of Practical Anarchism, A Guide for Daily Life, and also the co-editor of Surviving the Future, Abolitionist Queer Strategies. On that episode, 228, we talked about how to see the world through the lens of anarchism. Well, obviously, a lot has happened in the world since then, and recently Shuli asked me to be on their show, The Breakup Theory, which is brand new. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this crossover podcast, because I really wanted to turn people on to that show. It's a very sort of contemporary feeling and exciting and very deep and multi-directional anarchism podcast. And that is the other reason why I'm cross-posting this episode, because the conversation was so good. We talk about politics and spirituality and encounters with the challenges of our moment. I really love the conversation, and I want to make sure more people heard it. The episode starts by touching on a kind of deep cut of Against Everyone with Connor Abib, episode 9, which I later reposted as episode 132, How to Break Up with the State. That was a solo episode where I talked about how we're entangled in something like a relationship with the state that ended a long time ago, but we keep getting pulled back in to engagement with that relationship for various reasons. And that informed some of Shuli's thinking and maybe even the name of their podcast. The primary question of that episode was, why do we stay in relationships with states that obviously don't have our interests in mind? And that does kick off this episode, but then it goes in lots of places. Some questions that come up are, should we be practicing good politics or anti-politics? What does that mean, anti-politics? How are we baited by elections? Is nonviolence effective? What does a spiritual politics that doesn't just turn into theocracy look like? Are non-abstract politics possible? In other words, where do we start politics from, if not just some abstraction? How does the state trick us into discussing and envisioning things on its terms so we lose the battle by the time we enter into mediation? Why do we wait for tragedies to take action? What are everyday practices of resilience that we might miss because we focus so much on when we are damaged? How do limits in love relationships teach us about politics? And what do we do with the fact that people have different desires when we're trying to form politics? That's something that I center around a lot when talking with Shuli, like, who says something like, anarchism is the only approach to living that says we might not all want the same things after the revolution, if indeed there is actually a revolution. Maybe the revolution in some ways is just realizing that we don't all want the same things, so we're going to have to live together in spite of that. And what does that mean when some people have destructive desires, desires that are destructive to the other, or more commonly destructive to I don't like the word collective, but destructive to the commons, I would say. It's such an expansive conversation. I love talking with Shuli, and I hope you love listening. I'll be back with more sort of normal episodes. I'm trying to find my way as I go here with what I'm doing with this year's episodes. I hope you're enjoying them, and I hope you enjoy this one. Before I give you my pitch for my Patreon, I will say that Shuli and The Breakup Theory have a Patreon as well, and I encourage you to support it. It's The Breakup Theory, so it's patreon.com/The Breakup Theory, all one word, obviously. I think it's really great to support people that are just starting new projects and doing interesting things. So patreon.com, The Breakup Theory. An episode that you can pair with this one is the first episode of this year, which was 248, How Can I Find Peace in a Time of War? I talk about some of the things I talk about on this episode, but in a more spiritual, esoteric light. Okay, so please do support this show. Patreon.com/Connor Habib is the best way to do it. And it's not just supporting the show, it's supporting everything I do by simply saying, with that connective gesture that economy allows. Hey, I like that you are being, I like that you're in the world being who you are. Because I really want to stress that I don't like the idea of people getting paid for their labor. That seems like a form of time theft to me. I think capitalist companies talk about time theft as when people are on the job and not doing anything. But I actually think time theft is more like paying people for their labor. We should be supporting each other. There should be some sort of association of people, kind of kinship to people through economy, if there needs to be the kind of economy that we have at all. Obviously, Patreon is still a tech company, but it is the best way that I've found to have that kind of relationship with people who are listening to the show or reading my novel or just looking at some of the other writing I've done, anything I've done in the past, or coming to events that I'm setting up. So patreon.com/ConorHabib. Please do support the show and what I'm up to if it brings meaning and new thoughts and new directions to your life. Okay, so here's my conversation with Shuli Branson, which originally appeared on the podcast, The Breakup Theory. Here we go.
When I was writing my book, Practical Anarchism, I was thinking about breaking up as something that can help us frame liberation. And then I was inspired by this episode that you did early on in your podcast on breaking up with the state. And then you reposted it with a new intro at the end of the first COVID year. I think the first one was responding to the 2016 election and the way that people talk about the lesser of two evils. But like you're responding to this time, these times, these moments where the violence of the state came clearly into view and that we can't hope for the state to save us. And if anything, I think it's become more explicit that this is what states are about. Like Israel to me is like a kind of shows the end goal of state power, which is like glee and killing, total control of movement, consolidation of ethnicity, race, religion to unify, you know, under nationalism. And then the movement of solidarity with Palestinians is exposing people again to the ways that states will not respond to the will of the people or whatever. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you got to the idea of breaking up with the state. And if you think about it differently now, because it's been a few years since you first articulated it.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I'm not sure I actually formulated it originally as like breaking up. I just thought a lot about all the things that we do without the state that we pretend are actually provided to us by the state. And so there were a lot of things that were inspiring that Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, but also Adam Phillips, the psychoanalyst, you know, writing about stop signs and how traffic actually, like that we actually stop more often and there are less accidents when we remove the stop signs, just sort of how to grapple with that kind of stuff. And so I think, first of all, seeing how connected we can be without the structures that we put in place. And there is something about that in our relationships too, because we often feel we have to name the relationships that we have, this or that. And it becomes hyper articulated now where it's like, I'm in this kind of polycule. Obviously, the largest one is just still the standard. We're monogamous, we're married, whatever. So I should probably call that one out first before I start talking about the alternative ones that don't deserve as much scrutiny from people that aren't in those kinds of relationships. But I think the naming and the ways that we adhere to structures that actually are just a kind of dross over what we do already and what is already in our own interests and what we'd like to do and explore and understand. I do think that we constrain ourselves then with that. And so I think that that's where it came from. But then as I was developing that episode and just sort of deepening, I was like, oh yeah, we need to understand that the state is going one way and we're going the other way. And like increasingly, if I just add one more thing here, what you're saying was like, oh, it's just become worse. Increasingly, it's just become obvious that not only is the state not listening to the will of the people or mediating when we make demands, but actually it now just seems completely like something that has to be overcome at all times, especially in the US, where it just is like everything that the government does seems like a challenge, a gauntlet thrown down, and something that we have to go through these long, insane battles to overcome. And it's just obvious that we've gone our separate ways. So starting with that actually, I probably should have called the episode, "We've already broken up with the state," you know, like a stop staying in the relationship that you're actually not in anymore. Stop trying to re-engage, you know, and see where we're actually at and the distance that's between us and start from there.
That's actually, thinking about it that way, that it's something's already happened or this process has been going on for a while, that breaking up is helpful. I mean, it even makes me feel a little bit hopeful. And I've tried to have that perspective over the last number of years, that it's becoming clearer to people that the lie of the state as providing services to people is a lie. And then people are, you know, more engaged in mutual aid projects or doing direct actions and other kinds of resistance. So thinking that like there's a historical shift that's happening. And then, you know, like you're pointing out with the US, like it's so bald that the anti-trans legislation is just a grasp for power and more control over people's bodies. And you see this around the world in the growing fascist movements, that the states are more explicitly just holding on to power through violence as much as they can. And, you know, when you originally talked about it, or maybe this was like when you revisited it, but you were talking about it as an abusive relationship,
right,
which I thought was really, really interesting, because I don't know, maybe that's helpful to think about why we've like broken up and stayed, right? Because like the
right,
phenomenon around abuse is that what it's so hard to leave, even when you know that you're being abused. What do you think that's like continuing to trap us in that?
Yeah, I think that there's so many answers to that question. I'm not sure which one I would land on, or if we could just try to put them in a row and see if a truth emerges from all of them next to each other. But I think I would have added that to, we've already broken up, but the state is the one that won't admit it, right? But of course, a lot of people who aren't state agents also, well, in the sort of typical sense, won't admit that either. They just don't know it. But I mean, if people can reflect on relationships they've been in where like, you know, the relationship is over, but you just haven't said anything to your partner yet. Like, it's not just the declarative moment. It's actually the process has already been done. Something has changed inwardly that is, you know, leading you to to that one decisive moment. So yeah, so the state is definitely holding on to the relationship, and that's part of the abuse. It's like keeping you in constant engagement. And that is, I mean, the state's tactic is, well, if we can get you to engage with us daily, again and again and again and again, you never get to leave the relationship. Another sort of way of thinking about this is, you know, when you break up with somebody and they keep sending you like argumentative texts, as if the argument has to continue anymore, you can actually start a new relationship with the person. Not that I'm suggesting we start a new kind of relationship with the state, but the moment you start getting in the argument because they've applied pressure to your feeling life, you're back in. You're back in the engagement. And the state does that in lots of different ways. And I mean, obviously, elections, presidential elections especially, are the most obvious example where they really attack the feeling life of everybody that's in the US, especially, and get them really whipped up into an argument that actually is completely irrelevant.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, how the state brings us onto its terrain, which is another way of saying what you were just saying, you know, with the anti-trans stuff, people think, oh, we have to like go to the courts or petition the politicians and get new policy written. And like the lesson of the overturning of Roe v. Wade is that that kind of fight on their terrain doesn't work. And seeing it now, I've been thinking about it a lot in the kind of street protest movement for Gaza, that even anarchists will fall into the same vocabulary or grammar of protest, which like ends up being like a demand for a politician to listen to you, to do a thing. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, also we don't have the power here in the US or in Ireland, right, or wherever, to end the bombardment of Gaza, the invasion of Gaza, the genocide there. Like, I don't know, we get pushed into these things that feel almost like relics of that. We keep marching in circles and there's like nowhere to go. And so I'm trying to think, I don't know what your thoughts might be on this, like a kind of breaking up with politics. I'm trying to like think of through anti-politics and how that
becomes
our vision.
God, I'd love, that's something I think about all the time. But first, I just want to, before I say something about that, I do want to question this thought that we actually
are not powerful enough to stop the war, the massacre.
Yeah.
I have such mixed feelings about framing it that way, because one, like, there'll be listeners of this show that like really hate this, but like, I'm basically as close to a pacifist as you can get. Like, I think for the most part, I'd rather die than act out in violence that wasn't direct self-defense in most ways. Yeah. Now, I know not everybody agrees with that, but I don't think that shuts down the conversation for everybody else. That's my life and that's my way of being. I do think that there's potential direct action through nonviolence. I don't agree that it's completely useless, like some people say. I do think that we should question why we continue to say that the masses don't have the power to stop the military and the government. And, you know, for me, part of that answer is simple, because I'm not willing to engage in the most obvious tactic, which would be violence, to achieve that aim. But it seems like maybe there is a kind of asymmetry that we've been duped into accepting, that that might be way more accessible. I know this is like really tricky territory to navigate, but I was thinking about the night after Donald Trump won the election. I went to go see Rebecca Solnit speak with my friend Joanna McNeil, and she was, you know, hired to talk about maps and map making, and she ended up talking about the Kyoto Protocol and like environmental stuff and how Trump was going to turn all those over and we were all doomed. And I just thought, well, if you really think that, how, like, what's the actual moral and ethical course to take here? If the stakes are the extinction of humanity, like, what are we doing here? And so I think it's really important to think about, if we agree upon the stakes, why we allow why we allow ourselves to stop at, well, we don't have the power to change this. I'm not saying you're doing that. I use the same terms all the time. Like, I say the same kind of thing that you just said all the time. So I'm not trying to hold you accountable I do the same. But it's a question that I think should be investigated a little bit more. Can I just say one more thing, like, yeah, taking course. Up the political? And I think this is something that anarchists would maybe like more than a lot of anarchists would say or admit, a politic that actually flows out of the cultural rather than vice versa, which seems to be actually a little bit more of a Marxist move, where culture is determined by and expressed by political material conditions. I'd rather see politics emerging from a cultural realm and economics emerging from a political realm. In other words, what we want, what we desire, what our spiritual longings are, our sexual longings, our sense of discovery and care as individuals, and then moving into the political realm from there. Another way of saying this is one thing you say all the time, which is like, anarchism is the one theory or approach that says we might not all want the same thing. And how do we come to terms with the fact that we might not want the same thing? And I think that that's a question of negotiating cultural impulses through coming together and discussing them, which that is the political realm to me. Right now, it seems like there's this really overdetermined political presence, and it's actually almost like worshipped by people that somehow there are political solutions for all our problems. But I think that that's because the political realm seems to dominate the cultural realm, and the economic realm seems to dominate the political realm as well. So it's like this constant diminishment and demeaning of value and concern and meaning in our own lives and what we love and what we are interested in. And that's where I'd like politics to emerge from. And I'd be okay with that kind of politics. But the politics that just is constantly has its boot on the neck of culture, I'm not into that at all.
Well, I think that's interesting, because then we're circumscribing politics in a way. I mean, you're almost sort of at the Hannah Arendt definition of politics as like something that happens in the public sphere as like discussion, rather than, I think, like, we have this idea that it's everything. And I think, like, even anarchists fall into that with leftists often. And I would connect that to the thing that you were saying earlier about violence, because one of the things that I've seen unleashed so clearly in this moment of watching Israel escalate the genocide in Gaza is how it's just unleashed this libidinal pleasure, this pleasure in violence, right? Both for people who support Israel and
totally
for the people who want to support decolonial movements, right? And like, I find myself just feeling not good about our side, right? The like decolonial side relishing violence, because it to me, I mean, I love Fanon, and like, I don't think I would describe myself as a pacifist, but I also think continuing the cycle of violence is what got us here, right? That like Israel can claim the legacy of the Shoah as the reason why they need to perpetuate violence, which creates endless violence between Jews and Muslims in that region, which like I was brought up saying like all Arabs want to kill all Jews, right? And like that's not true, but we can just like continue to perpetuate these endless cycles. And I think just like to connect that back to the thing like you were saying, like maybe like anarchists wouldn't like this pacifist stance, is that I think there's a tendency to fetishize revolutionary violence by all manner of liberatory politics that doesn't grapple with the fact that doing that is basically willing people to death. So going back to the thing where I was saying, you know, we don't have the power to end the genocide, but like we feel like we must act. And I, whenever I'm having these discussions, I end up with this point where like, well, anything I say about what we can gain from this moment in trying to show up in solidarity for Palestinians cannot redeem the massacre of upwards of 20,000 people and ongoing. Like that's not redeemable. And there's no world in which I will that towards the end of like liberation for all, the mass death. But I think revolutionary politics tends to say that mass death is worth it, you know, to get to some point of liberation. So I don't know. That was my attempt to kind of connect some of those things. I don't know.
No, they're totally connected. I really appreciate that articulation, because I think that, like, again, we do not really have an adequate language to talk about peace. We just don't. It's not really articulated. Even when we try to, we start talking about nonviolence. So you can already see that that's just one of those classic and postmodern terms, oppositional terms that reinforces what it says it's opposing. But like, I wonder what it actually means to begin to speak about and articulate what peace is. And I don't condemn people for believing in the language which they understand, which is violent resistance, like struggle, on the ground struggle. That it's just not up to me. But I do think that I have, not that I live up to it, but I try to live up more and more to the responsibility of articulating the language that I do want to use to approach the problem, and to approach something that I understand, and I think a lot of abolitionists understand, is something that we're all in together. Like, we all have to figure out how to live with each other and how to do this massive thing of living with each other, which is why it's really valuable to think about things in terms of love relationships, where you learn so much about yourself and other at the same time. But I think I'm trying to understand how to talk about that, how to approach it, what it means, what it looks like. I mean, I have some thoughts on it, but that's where my commitment lies. And I'm not going to tell everybody, no, don't talk about terms of, you know, a violent resistance colonization until I come up with my best answer. But I do think that some of that has to do with, again, the political realm as such. In other words, political economy banishing the cultural, spiritual, individuated realm of our lives. I understand that also, like, I'm separating things in a way that many people might not be comfortable into these three spheres, which is culture, political rights, and economy. But those have been used by a lot of different theorists and a lot of different time periods. So that's kind of just how I'm theorizing about it right now.
I mean, your point that nonviolence as the opposite of violence is interesting. It made me think about how Sophie Lewis, there's a piece that Sophie wrote about that you can't have nonviolence in abortion, like ending a gestation. She's saying that we ought to acknowledge that it involves some kind of killing or death. And then Sophie comes up with this term of nonviolence there, which again, like, because, uh-huh. You know, we're trying to figure out what we're like relating to. But I think there's an acknowledgement that we can't, and this is something that abolitionists always will say, is that there's no world where no one hurts each other. We can't have that illusion. And I think, you know, going back to this understanding of politics, I think what happens often, what seduces so many people is this desire to control what other people think or do. You know, going back to this thinking about anarchism as the way to try to imagine us all wanting different things. I don't know, we often get caught in this idea that, like, we know, our side knows exactly how things should be. I find anarchists doing it, right? Having that authoritarian impulse and framing the stuff through like relationships, like the way that you talk about breaking up with the state, I think is a way to perhaps desist with that form of power and control and think about it differently, how we approach each other. I think we can take power analysis into our relationships, and that's helpful when we're talking about like abuse and stuff like that, or like engaging in conflict. So I'm not saying like power is not helpful, but when we bring the scale down to thinking about on the terms of relationship, I think that changes. And so I'm like connecting this back also to like this interrelated aspect or like interdependent thing that you're talking about, because that's a different way of framing it rather than like who gets governed and who gets to govern or who makes decisions for whom, which I just think that the, you know, European Enlightenment understanding of politics, tracing it back all the way to the Greeks, ends up thinking about politics as that, separating the governed from the governing bodies. And so we're always like seduced into that. Even I think like the attempts to get out of it, like anarchism, fall into this like Enlightenment structure. So when I'm thinking about anti-politics, I'm just reading Klee Ben Ali's book, No Spiritual Surrender, and he just passed, but he frames this through his anti-politics and a kind of use of nihilism to connect with indigenous movements, which for him is often thinking about a spiritual totality and like engagement with the land. And this is something I know that you think about a lot. So I maybe asking you to kind of connect it, just because like so much of this sort of Enlightenment political thinking is connected to a disenchantment of the world and separating us from the earth in a way that we can have dominion over it. And I know that you are really always pushing to kind of like, maybe, I don't know if you would say like a re-enchantment of the world, but like a spiritual engagement, right? That to me, like, you know, the way that Klee talks about it is like that spiritual engagement would encompass all the things that get called, that separated out, like politics and economics and culture. It's like a whole way of being.
I love that you're bringing up Klee, who like I became familiar with just before he died. And I was so excited to have a conversation with him. I'm also reminded of, you know, Russell Means here, who really was kind of angry with Marxists, saying like, look, you're basically doing the same thing as capitalists when it comes to indigenous people, which is that you're funneling everything into questions of like function and having and gaining. It may not be the same kind, but you've already started off with the wrong question, which the question should be about being. And I really love, you know, that's from, I don't know if it was an essay he wrote or a talk he gave, which is entitled The Same Old Song. And it's really great. I read it when I was very young. And it really blew my mind. And I think for me, the question to start from is, you know, what is the human being? Now, I think when people ask that question, a lot of times they're asking it from a place that I find actually a little distasteful, which is like evolutionary psychology or the sort of Enlightenment philosophy. What is a man? You know, like that kind of thing. I don't mean it like that. I mean, you know, when we really begin to connect with our own experience of being, like, what do we discover? And can we trace a path to how we live with others from that, rather than coming up with some sort of bizarro, really rather arbitrary abstract system and then just casting it over everything and deciding to adhere to that system at all costs? I think one of the things that's really tricky is it brings us into questions of morality rather than ethics. And that's something that a lot of people feel very uncomfortable with, particularly leftists, although that does seem to be changing a little bit, which is interesting to me, which is, you know, the political realm really is like an ethical realm in a way. It's like, how do we fit all these things together? Now, a lot of people have really bad ethics in the political realm, but because it's all really determined by people coming together to navigate material conditions, it's necessarily ethical. But when it comes to questions of the individual and culture and spirituality, we have something that's a little more like morality. This is something that's been really heartening to me about the protests for Gaza, even though I agree with you that the demand for ceasefire is, it's like we're making a demand of the state. And also ceasefire is such a withered term, you know, like it's powerful in its own way. So I don't want to completely dismiss it, but it's also like, well, who's firing? Like, what? Like this sounds like a both sides thing already inherently. And will it stop just because it's ceased for a minute? And who's declaring that it stopped, like the person who was funding it or doing it. I mean, it's just absurd, but I get it. And that's not to say people shouldn't do that. However, I think the real strength in this movement is coming from the fact that people have been completely bombarded by propaganda that is pandering to one ethical sense or another. Well, look, here's the history of the region. Look, these people have been fighting for hundreds of years or whatever kind of bullshit people say. Look, here's this hospital and Hamas blew up the hospital. No, the IDF blew up the hospital. No this, no that. So even the stuff that I agree with as factually accurate, that's not what's really coming into the realm of why people are protesting now, which is, I think, so strong and beautiful, which is we're actually out here because of the truth. But the truth is not given to us by information or ethics. The truth is a moral truth. And the moral truth of the matter is that people deserve to thrive, to live, to encounter their own lives, to fall in and out of love. And state violence is the antithesis of that. So state violence is always a lie. And so the truth is that the state should not be killing people. They just should not be killing people. And that's why we're out here. And the thing that's coming through that are thousands upon millions of conversations about why people are out there. You know, Deleuze used to say this thing that, like, well, with Guattari, that philosophy's special power basically is to create new concepts. But that's also the power of movements. And that's something Michael Hart points out, but that movements also create concepts. And so new ways of seeing are being built from these actions and these tactics of all these people coming together, but they're coming together in the name of a truth that's deeper than merely the sort of level of information or even context, which is wild and great. And the more people stay close to that, the more it actually makes them immune or inoculates them against further and deeper propaganda, because it stops mattering so much whose side is correct and actually like the deeper truth is reached for. And you can see this in a lot of ways, like also obviously the, you know, Jewish Voices for Peace and a lot of other Jewish people are, you know, saying this never again means never again to anybody. You know, that's right. One of the rallying cries there, which is like, yeah, this principle is actually much deeper than aside information, all that kind of stuff. So I think that's responding to your question in a really roundabout way, which is when we're talking about the spiritual value of being, the spiritual strength and potency of being, that's very different than trying to sort of sort everything out and come up with a solution to a problem. And that's, I think, where we start from. And while Klee is maybe starting with the earth, I think we can also just start from the human being. Who are we?
Yeah, I would like even respond to that from my own personal experience as like a Jewish person, because like a lot of Jews are raised with this idea that like Jewishness means a certain kind of moral relationship to the world. And I was raised with that. And using that perspective, I can get to the place that Israel is acting in an immoral way, right? Because I grew up studying the Holocaust and interviewing survivors. And then I can see the actions that they do, not just right now in Gaza, but over the last 75 years in all of these ways, beyond 75 years, because it happened before, in the name of a state, which tries to stand in for all Jews, as the same actions that were trying to wipe out Jews in Europe. Yeah, to like kind of connect that to what you're saying, connect to the beginning of our conversation with states, like when you take the state perspective, then these things become sides, and we need political solutions. When you look at it on the ground, people interact with each other in all of these complex ways that you can't just like label abstractly, which is why I think you have to say, like, when you're saying like concepts come from movements, that's also like a black, you know, black feminist thing, is that like that our theories come from what we do. And when we go into the moment with loaded with concepts preformed and try to apply it to the world, we come up short, which is another one of the reasons why I resist Marxism, because they like want to talk about all the things we do in our daily lives, but label them in these ways that make them completely obscure. It's like a further alienation. Yeah. I mean, we can see this very explicitly that the state of Israel, you know, attempts to capture Jewishness and identify all Jews with it, and then act in the name of like the many, you know, as this one violent force. But this movement has shown that a lot of people will refuse that. And I think that's important, because we can counter this idea that Arabs and Jews are like you know, millennia of of like antipathy or something, which isn't true. People lived in those lands without having all out war against each other. It's not to say there's never conflict or anything, but yeah, I mean, and I think that's why, you know, Klee, in talking about the resistance for indigenous people against leftist movements, is because the leftist articulation of politics and strategy, it can always be reconciled with settler colonialism for yeah. Klee, right? Because there's no way that kind of language can apprehend the spiritual essence or spiritual relationship to the land. It can't think of land as spirit, right? And it can't get to this kind of something beyond materialism, quantifying or extracting resources, right? And can't think of a relationship of interdependence, only a relationship of dominion and ownership. And I also just think that, like, when even anarchists who are anti-left or anti-politics frame themselves through a kind of anti-religion, a knee-jerk anti-religion, which I think is mostly just rejecting Christianity, like a kind of colonial state-based Christianity, fall into this Enlightenment thinking that doesn't allow for that kind of connection.
Yeah, what I forget who it was, but someone just sent me some anarchist who I've read his work before, who wrote actually quite a great book, but I forget his name, The Joy of Revolution. Do you know that book? Now, Ken Nabb, maybe. Just, you know, sent out, like, in the midst of everything, you know, some stuff that the Situationists had said about Israel-Palestine. It was like, great. But then it's like this whole thing about how Arabs have to, you know, throw off the shackles of Islam, you know, like if they ever want to really be free. And I'm like, what the? It's so absolutely stupid because of the amount of Arabs who do things that look like Situationist interventions through Islam. First of all, we could talk about that, but also it's really missing, if we want to just talk about it only in terms of changing power or dissolving power or whatever, it's just missing so much of the potential that's there. I think it's really funny, like, that concept that Foucault has about political spirituality is, like, kind of coming back into everybody's face, because you can see people from Gaza just saying, like, basically the thing that's helping me get through this is knowing that God is with us and knowing that, like, my family is going to a better place right now after they've been killed. And to sort of mark that as delusion now, absolutely, it just seems like completely preposterous. Like, not because we all have to convert to Islam or believe in the same set of spiritual ideas, but because we can see that it's not having a weakening effect on people's spirit or even, like, their tactics or strategies of resistance against colonialism. So that's just out the window at this point. I'm not saying there can't be bad versions of that. There can be. But to wholesale, like, reject it because you're an anarchist, or more commonly, probably because you're a Marxist, I mean, it's just completely obviously is not true anymore.
I don't want to, like, exoticize or exceptionalize, or again, like, try to be redemptive of this moment for Palestinians, but, like, the things that you hear people saying who are undergoing this terrible massacre, these people are articulating the things that we're talking about, which is, like, a sense of, like, being able to connect across difference, right? Ideas of hospitality, not simple vengeance and you know, desire for revenge, which is what to me the Israel and the Zionists sort of embody, is this, like, this idea of revenge. People, like, hold up this just things that, like, Palestinians will say about, like, I want to share a meal with you or something like that, right? Like, which leads me back to something that you said, like, at the very beginning, in terms of framing about breaking up with the state, pointing to the fact that there's these things that we already do, which is that's a kind of argument that anarchists tend to make. I've said that in ways before. One of the things that I was, like, really responding to in your initial point was that it's actually, like, a matter of bringing attention to things that we're doing and seeing the power in that, rather than because we're trained to look elsewhere all the time and disregard the things that we do that actually make life possible, that aren't engaged with the state, that aren't engaged with, like, national identities that have to be warring with other identities, right? That kind of essentialize that difference and make them antithetical to one another. Like, there's all of these moments where we are living outside of that purview and we're navigating difficult, complex issues, right? Like, like having to deal with all these other people that have all these other worlds inside of them, which again, I think this is like the thing that gets left out or just made impossible by the kind of state framing that we can continuously talk. Like there's no possibility of Jews and Arabs or Muslim Arabs living peacefully in the same land. It's like such a ridiculous idea that like sort of training our attention to other points of view, I think is really important. And one of the things that you talked about in one of these moments of like breaking up with the state is like that feeling like when our attention comes to that very clearly when there's a crisis and we respond to a crisis, right? People will always bring up like mutual aid in a kind of whatever, an ecological disaster moment, or like COVID. People helped each other, right? And then after the crisis seems to recede, or like there's an ebb in it, there's like a kind of nostalgia or yearning for that moment of crisis where we were able to see how we can organize our own lives, which is like, I think, a tricky experience. Like I was in New York for September 11th, and the world stopped for 2 weeks. And when the world went back to normal, I was like, I had such a hard time moving on from those 2 weeks where people were relating to each other in a very different way in New York. That's just like another example of like that kind of like nostalgia or yearning for something that you don't want to will this thing to happen, like disasters where people die or aren't harmed. So I'm like, I've been very interested in thinking about that, because like in the streets, one of the things that happens when we have these massive movements is that people form relationships in the streets, but they come through these exceptional moments of like crisis. And for those who are like struggling for liberation, we're always kind of put in this reactive position where that's the only time that we can do the things we need to do. And how do we look at the off moments, those in-between moments that aren't heightened by crisis, to think about the ways our relationship are not captured by the state?
Yeah. I think it's so important what you're saying. I'll say a couple things about it. Let me just start with saying, I have a friend who she was telling me she was at a pub here in Ireland, and she was with her friends, and this guy was like hitting on her, and they were all kind of like, there's something weird about this guy. And at a certain point, he like put his hand around her neck, and she said something like, would you remove your hand? And then he did. And they walked out, and her friends were really kind of freaking out. And she's like, I'm fine. We don't really pay attention. We pay way more attention to someone who was groped at a club who feels deeply violated, which is fine. I'm happy to talk about that. The fact that some people don't have something within them that allows them to not have that sense of violation and intensity when something is done to them, where they have some sort of strength in their non-reactivity, but also that things just kind of don't touch them in the same way. Obviously, I'm not saying that's accessible for everybody. I'm saying that the times that we notice stuff like that in our own lives, we should attenuate ourselves to it. What is it in me that allowed me to feel strength in that moment and to be not afraid in that moment? Because that's something that we don't do. In the way that you're talking about, we're always kind of waiting for the bad thing to show up. So when it does show up, instead of just waiting for the next bad thing to show up, we can look at the points and places in which we are resilient and think about how that appears in our daily lives, in our personalities, in our surroundings, and in our friends and people that we know. It's something I said to someone who's a prominent organizer, and she just did not get it in a way that was really frustrating. In fact, she was kind of very dismissive to me about it, about Gussa, was I said, you know, I'm so glad people are coming together, but why does it always take actual human sacrifice before people wake up to the presence of, you know, the need for peace? Like we should stop meeting blood sacrifice at this point. Like we just shouldn't need it anymore. And that goes for everybody. I would say that equally for the ways that people come together in communities where anybody, any, of course, person of color, any Jewish person, any gay person, any trans person, whether it's a nightclub or a synagogue shooting, or it's the slaughter of people in Gaza, we wait to come together. It's like we're ignited somehow by blood spilling. And that shouldn't be. We should pay attention to and kind of light up and live into what we do already without that. But failing that, at least look at the times when the violence did arise and we responded and we came together, see how there's a continuity between that and our everyday lives. Where does that continuity exist? And that's the actual opposite to what a lot of people do, which is this other thing that I think is really damaging, where I think the best example of what I want to talk about here is like during the Trump presidency, the ways in which people were constantly freaking out about things that actually didn't affect their everyday lives. Let me get a little more specific here. Like people would have these like, you know, Trump's doing this. He passed this law. He's like signing this executive order. He's trying to do this and this and this. And people were like constantly in this like royal about it. But then if I were like, okay, can you actually stand back and tell me how that's affecting your life? They would say, no, it wasn't. Right. Like, well, they would have to admit that it actually didn't. I'm not saying there are people who obviously were affected by some of those executive orders and so on and so forth. And certainly the cultural conditions that were being drummed up. But people feel more inclined to be whipped up into a frenzy about something that doesn't affect them and confuse the feeling of anxiety for action than actually standing back and saying, this doesn't affect me, yet I still want to stop this from happening. I still want to take action. So on the one hand, we have people not attenuating to the strengths that they already have in their lives. And on the other hand, we have people highly exaggeratedly attenuating to things that feel weakening to them, but that actually aren't, and that could lead them into real action that doesn't require them being enmeshed in the terrible situation to still care about others who are.
I think you're getting at something that I would maybe talk about in terms of complicity in these power systems, which I think one of the ways that the state kind of operates through identification is to, not with our consent, to bind us into complicity with these terrible actions. So like, I could look at that moment in the pub that you were talking about a different way, where the woman who is assaulted has been inured to that kind of male violence by living as a woman all the time, because, you know, being a femme is being in this culture subjected to that kind of violence on a daily basis. So it's like not exceptional. And the men's reaction of like wanting to, you know, react or protect or whatever comes from their relative removal from that violence, or even their potential enactment of similar violences. But they want to react because also we like respond to this kind of idea of victimization. So they're also enacting a kind of male gendered kind of relationship to her. And so there's part of me that wants to push back and be like, it's not simply resilience, but like a sort of being beaten down into just like accepting the fact that this is a misogynist world and that violence is normalized, which I think we could also relate to what's happening in Gaza, that it has been so normalized, but this moment has broken out partially because I would say because like we're like witnessing it on social media, and which brings it into a kind of more intimate space than the like normal news media's portrayal of things. And then I want to connect back to the thing about Trump, because I think one of the things that's happening here, how politics is framed, how our identification of the state is made possible or facilitated, is through like media, through spectacle. And so like one of the things that's happening there with Trump, which I find interesting, if we like take the step back outside of the kind of like binary politics of the US, the media can whip up a frenzy in response to Trump and create this idea that he's exceptional. Everything that Trump did laid the groundwork for Biden to push further into all of those policies. Right? Yeah. And then there's no reaction to Biden because we have this like narrative that allows this kind of constant revolving door to happen, where like they're all doing the same shit, but like one side is framed as like evil and the other side is framed as like lesser evil. And then it makes us kind of accept those things. But yeah, I don't know if I have more to say except to kind of put the question to you about like this idea of complicity, because I think that's something that we're grappling with right now in relation to this massacre in Gaza, but also other disasters like, you know, Congo in Sudan, and how all of us are tied into this global network of money, basically. How do we grapple with that?
I mean, just to go back, let me just make one more point about the hand on my friend's neck. Like I would say like another way that I could frame that was, you know, when I was making movies, this guy did something to me that would have been really violating perhaps to another person, but I just kind of like got irritated and I was like, stop. And I don't use that to judge other people's experiences of whether or not they feel violated by something that somebody's done to them. but rather as a starting point for me to inquire about my own resilience and understanding. And does that come from just being inured to certain kinds of things, or is it actually something else? But even if it was me being inculcated into a culture of people like harming each other in very specific ways that are attached to political structures or ideas, like, still, what is it about me? What do I get out of being able to walk away from that experience without having been harmed? And what can I communicate to others? Because certainly those harms are going to continue to happen to people, or those encounters, I should say. And how are people going to deal with it without constantly just funneling into a place of especially traumatic harm? You know, and how is that different from experiences that where I was assaulted sexually and physically that did cause trauma? And like, how can I look at those differently? I think that the question of, I was just laughing because I was like, well, that's the big question.
Right.
You know, I always think that like, remember that meme that was like going around for a while where it was like the peasant carrying the sack, you know, it's like that. And they were like, I wish things were better, you know? And then it's like the guy coming out of the well, he's like, interesting, but you participate in the system, yeah. You know? And everybody said that, like, the obvious thing to say about that is the cartoon's point, which is like that the guy in the well is an asshole. And like, of course, we're all in this system. And, you know, what do we do? But I do think it's actually also important to take his point as serious, right. Which is like, what is our fault? Obviously, this is something that is co-created by us. I think that one of the big alternatives to that is like conspiracy theory, which is like it's all being orchestrated and our strings are being pulled. And, you know, there are sheeple and there are people who are awake and whatever. I don't buy into that picture. Although, of course, there are people and institutions in power and forces at play. But I do think it's important to think about how we're responsible, and how much of that responsibility we're able to take on is a completely different question. We all have our limits. I think I can learn a little bit about some of this from a relationship. I had a boyfriend who, he was in a lot of ways not a very good boyfriend for a long time, but he taught me quite a bit because I had really serious depression while I was with him. Now, a lot of times the episodes were triggered by him, but we'll leave that aside for a second. He did at a certain point say, like, you have to understand, just because you get depressed, that doesn't mean like I can do anything about it. And I was like, oh, it was true. Now, I'm not saying that's a good response for people to say to their partners, but the solution that arose from that was actually really helpful, which was, okay, because I would get really upset with him afterwards for not responding in the right way, quote unquote, the right way when I was having an episode. And I'm sure that's going to be familiar to a lot of people that are listening. Yeah. Like, you're having your like episode, your horrible thing, and you're so in it. And then the person you're with is like, why the fuck aren't they, you know, helping me? Because they actually can't know your interiority. Not everybody is equipped, and you can really see where people's limits are. So what I said was, okay, listen, if you do these three things, one was very simple. It was like, just tell me that things are going to be all right and just hold me. Yeah. Two is bring the dog into the room, because the dog was this big, ridiculous standard poodle that was like impossible to not laugh around most of the time. And the other was, there was a closet that had nothing in it in the guest room. There was nothing in it. And so like sometimes when he and I would get in fights, we would go in there because we had agreed that like there was no fighting in that little closet. So I was like, if it's really bad, just take me in there and set me down, because there's like no bad mojo in there. It's like,
yeah,
those three things might not work. I might still be in a really bad place, but I promise you that I will see that you've done everything you can to support me in that moment if you've done that. And they're very simple things. And I think that that's actually part of what we can try to do in our lives, is think about what our limits are for solving these problems. Some of us have way more space, and our limits are much farther out or further out than other people's are. And we can do a lot more things. And we can also discover what our limits are by by engaging. You know, like right when the stuff kicked off, I hate that. Like right when the stuff intensified in Gaza, you know, a friend of mine, she sent me a message and she was like, I'm so sorry, but I'm not going to post anything about this. You know, I'm going through a lot of physical pain because of, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she has, you know, a few disabilities. And I was like, it's totally okay. You don't have to post anything about it. But I think she was sensing that I had a completely monolithic view of how people should be responding and be vocal, but she just couldn't achieve that because she was in physical pain every single day because of the flare-ups that are happening. And I'm like, we all have our limits. So I think it's just really important to investigate those and to communicate to others how they can help you, how they can support you. Say, look in the face of events and come up with like the three things. And it's very hard because even that can sound like I'm letting people off the hook. But it's, again, that's something that comes from an exploration of being, not like I have to win this victory or I have to do this set of prescribed things, but rather I'm going to also reflect on my own being and what I am and who I am and where I am and like where I'm standing and respond based on that.
I think you sort of reframed this question of complicity as responsibility or accountability. And I like the way that you made that parallel in terms of relationship, because that moment that you're, that sort of interaction that you're describing is, yeah, definitely, I can identify with that on both sides. I've been on both sides of that.
Totally.
And like this feeling gets translated into like whatever social justice spaces too, I think, which is like what you're saying in terms of your friends like worry about your reaction on social media. But we like misunderstand or project expectations. We misunderstand the like possibilities of what other people can give us in these moments. And I think like this is something I've said in when I'm like doing these like sort of talks around breakup theory. I'm like, you know, there's one thing about caring for each other, but there's another gift we can give to each other, is like letting each other off the hook sometimes.
Totally.
And that's like sort of that conversation that you had with your boyfriend was a form of that, because what he thought he was maybe being like interpolated into is like solving your problem, which isn't solvable in a direct way, because it's like an existential thing that could like probably pop up through any number of instigating events. And so you have to get at it from a different angle. And that's like that misalignment is so common for conflicts in relationship. I mean, I just was like going through this the other day, and like you like think like, oh, someone's coming to me to solve problems. And then you go in your problem solving thing and make the situation worse because the other person's not ready to hear solutions. They're in a different space. So you articulate explicitly between you how you act in those moments to not escalate a situation. Yeah, I think that's a form of letting off the hook. I was like, oh, shoot, I'm like going into the Hannah Arendt again of like forgiveness is like a political. But I think that like, I think it's like this relief. And so connecting that back to the complicity question, I was thinking again how and maybe like what we can learn from Klee too, like the world that we live in with this like global connection through capitalism, like the flow of capital and the state's control of the movement of bodies, is a perversion of interdependence, right? It creates that complicity where we're all have blood on our hands because like all of the money is bloody and whatever. We're all connected to each other through these cycles of violence. And sometimes our attention is brought to it. And a lot of times our attention is made to not see it, to invisibilize that. And that to me is like when we take our attention away from the state and that form of political, social, economic organization, we can actually start to think about the ways that we can frame interdependence in a way that's not premised simply on violence, right? But that has, but still has room for conflict, and that can, you know, practice conflict in a way that's not simply harmful. I don't know. I guess maybe that's one of the things that I think is important for us to do, is like think about those sort of mundane moments as full of that significance. But I also see on this other hand, like throughout our talk, this has been coming up in the back of my head, that there's been a resurgence of, I've seen in like anarchist spaces, of the feeling like kill your rapist, of that we can only respond to harm with like revenge and violence. And I've talked with friends who are really struggling because they've been so harmed and felt manipulated through so-called like leftist abolitionist spaces to kind of try to silence them. And so I feel I understand that desire to like respond with violence to it. But I think that, I don't know, like I get stuck in this thing of like, again, those cycles of violence, the fact that we're all fucking traumatized, right? And like, you know, you were saying like, oh, well, there's some moments where I'm harmed and I can like bounce back. And there's other moments where I'm harmed, which like re-triggers the trauma. And that even happens in moments when we're not harmed because we've been so programmed. Like we're all acting out of this space of varied versions of trauma. I mean, to me, this is also in your book, and Hawk Mountain is why for me, it's that book was so like horrific to me, is like that, the way that like that kind of homophobia, internalized homophobia, and the violence around that is portrayed in that book was, I was chilled by that. Because that's like another one of those forces that I play.
So well, it's funny because I was just going to say, like, when you were talking about that, I was like, I want those people to read my novel, because that's exactly, that's my response. I can't respond in anything less complex than that, because it is so complicated. Of course, we've all had fantasies about really just fucking killing. First of all, it's not feasible and it usually doesn't happen. Like, mostly you're not going to kill your rapist. So you have to, like, first of all, like, just take that on as the reality. And then you don't have to necessarily banish the fantasy, though. You can say, what am I doing with this fantasy? Like, what is this giving to me? How do I work with it? You know, turn to your inner life and find out what's trying to be given to you through these fantasies that are utterly, you know, for the most part, generally, like, you can't act upon them and you can't do anything about it. And just sort of trying to build a politic out of a fantasy about killing somebody that harmed you is probably bad news. I mean, I gotta say, it's probably not a good politic. So, and how do we sympathize with each other's and find solidarity and care in each other's fantasies that will be unrealized as well? Like, that also has to be taken into account. And also the ways in which, like, false consciousness, you know, which is not a term I love, but I do think it's true sometimes. It's almost like some sort of weird extension of what you're talking about. Because again, when you say, I mean, so important the point you make that, like, how are we going to get along if we don't all want the same thing? Like, that is actually what anarchism is really trying to get to in a lot of ways. It, not just in political ways, but in all sorts of ways. How are we going to manage this? And, you know, the abolitionism takes that up in one way, which I think is great, but there's all sorts of levels of this. And one of the ways in which it comes up is in false consciousness, where, like, what about the person you meet that's like, but I love driving my SUV and, like, you know, like, tearing up the fucking ground with it. Like, I love that. How are you actually going to approach that person's sense of deeply held meaning, knowing that your concept that they're in a state of false consciousness is actually not really going to touch them? Like, how do you deal with that? You know, yeah. I guess, I mean, these are all real, really, as absurd as these questions probably seem to just standard leftist conversations, these are real questions that we have to ask, because the fact of the matter is a lot of people really love driving their SUVs. And so we've got to actually figure out how to talk. And I think some of that really is driven home by being in Ireland, for me, where people just have very, very, very different ideas of how to live. There's lots of cultural trauma, historical, political trauma, economic trauma that inheres in the way the country works now. And the solution was people sitting down and talking about it, finally, just being like, we can't, like, we're just not going to win out. Now, I'm not saying that there wasn't armed struggle or resistance that led up to that moment. There was. But at a certain point, it was understood that the tactic was exhausting itself, and that what had to happen was people actually had to sit down and see each other. And what did that mean? And the solution is obviously not perfect. And there's lots of problems that still exist here today because of it. But understanding the difference in desire and even the difference in, like, we tend to think of pain as one thing, but the difference in the contours of the pain and suffering that people are feeling across these, like, in some ways seemingly unbridgeable divides, and deciding, well, we've got to come and figure out a way to, like, live with all of this, and also live with the guilt we feel for doing violence, the guilt we feel for not doing enough to resist imperialism, and so on and so forth. And so I think all that comes into play when you say this thing about, like, kill your rapist is, like, part of what people are saying and talking about. But also it's coming into play for me when I'm just thinking, people want things that we think are completely fucking stupid. And probably, honestly, I'm just going to say I'm right sometimes in thinking that their desires are fucking dumb. Like, that's how I feel, at least, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up desire. Because for me, like, the next step after that idea that anarchism is trying to, or the task of anarchism is to be able to deal with the fact that not everyone wants the same thing. The next step is to, like, think about desire and pleasure and bring that into the conversation in a way that I don't think it gets like discussed. And so for me, the kill your rapist fantasy, I totally understand that fantasy, and I've had that fantasy. I've lived that in ways, but that to me is parallel to the thing that's being acted out by Israel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, and one of the things about politics, like, to go back to that, is like, it works like with like that Kantian categorical imperative, where you like takes the thing, the ethic is like whatever can be like universally legislated. But I think everyone gets individualized to that, where like my desire should be everyone's, or the right, there's a right way, and that needs to be universalized. And that becomes really harmful, because we all want different things. But then when I really push myself to think about this, like to imagine a world that was organized around this way, like where we had like little different enclaves of like autonomously organized spaces, that world would have to allow for the possibility that like the next town over is a Nazi town or something, right? If people choose to go to this place and organize through authoritarian, ethnic, racist ways, is it my duty to like stop them over there? If they don't have any power over me, right? And they're not doing anything to me, and people are thereby considered. Or, I mean, maybe we have to go and liberate the people who are under their thumb or something like that. But I mean, that's
there,
like,
we go.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Right.
I mean, I think that imagining of it, I completely understand it. And I also think that that's imagining the ways in which the enclaves would exist as like miniature versions of what we have now. But like actually what we need is a completely different way to organize the little enclaves as well. And I do think that it's not going to be total, and it's not going to happen the same way everywhere at once. Like the idea that we'll have an anarchist planet that emerges out of globalization, right? Like the globalized imagination. So it's going to happen different ways in different places. But I think one of the great ways to start it is looking at different models that have been created but not realized by people who had utopian ideals, not to create utopian states, although if they're good ones, who cares if that's where it ends up, but there are mostly no good ones, but rather to inspire us to really, really think differently, like really get kind of wild, so that we're not, just changing the size, like I said, or changing the one aspect about it, but not others. I've brought them up a few times, but Michael Hart's book, Subversive 70s, is so good. It's so good. And one of the reasons why it's so good is he says, you know, the 70s were ahead of us in a lot of ways, because so many of the propositions were truly radical. And some of them that bore fruit, like in Portugal, where people post-revolution are creating these commissions, where there are these little groups that are getting together that all have kind of different ways of fitting into society. They don't all have the same function. They don't all have the same people coming together. They don't have all the same people who have the same stakes coming together. It's very different. And then trying to meet with each other and discuss amongst the commissions, it's really inspiring. It sounds really boring the way I said it, but it's actually really inspiring the way that Michael wrote about it. But then also, like, I think, like if we have small groups of people that meet related to, well, gosh, we don't have enough time to go over this now. I'm about to give my big idea of the solution, but we don't have enough time to like actually go into it. But just so you know, utopia can wait, guys. But I think that the point really is just that we need to have like a truly radical imagination about how these things are going to be organized. And what that's going to mean is reaching for things that seem rather absurd to us. I mean, what are the like most infuriating things you can say to a Marxist is something that's completely true, which is that it's only marginally different from capitalism. Right. I mean, that's like absolutely piss everybody off that I say that to. And I think the marginal difference is probably better. I'm fine accepting that. And I like George Orwell's like sort of dictum that like we have to do socialism next before we do the thing that comes after socialism. But I don't know that we actually have to do it as a political organizational thing. We need to embody and internalize the lessons of what socialism gives us, which is that we're all interconnected. And you can prove that to yourself by just looking around the room and seeing that everything is there as a result of someone else's labor. And therefore, we are really deeply connected to everybody and all the processes. I think that that's so important. But I don't think that organizing merely around labor makes really any sense, because there's so many other things in our lives to pay attention to. And that's where we start to need to get really kind of wild and really weird. And that's why I think looking at some of the strangest propositions is actually a really great starting place for us, not to follow them to the letter, but to see what they kind of disturb and unsettle in us. And I think at a time when we're seeing that old tactics and strategies just don't work at all, that actually states are definitely not committed to mediation processes when we make demands of them, that could not be more obvious than now. I mean, it's like so glaring. That's the time where you start doing things that seem like they would make no sense. Mm-hmm. That actually it's time to just start doing the things that seem in some ways the craziest and seeing what happens, as long as we try to be, you know, loving to each other as we do it. And that's, I mean, I'm so sorry to end it with me, the statement was saying like, well, we just need to love each other. But that really is the foundation of what I'm doing, at least. I don't want to say that's for everybody else.
No, yeah. I mean, I think I love that you framed it all that way, because this to me comes back to where we started with breaking up the state. I also understand as doing this like internal work to see how I embody state logics and act those out against other people, which gets to that question of like the right desire or whatever, because like a lot of the desires that we have are kind of put into us through consumer culture and like those mm-hmm. SUV thing is like, you know, if I maybe wouldn't want that if I had other fulfillments in my life. And like also framing it through work distorts it, so we can't think about those things too,
right?
So
right.
Like we need to do all this work to kind of detach and disidentify, is how I talk about in that book, is like from those state logics that work through us all the time, so that we aren't like acting out this kind of top-down perspective all the time in our relationships. I love that you say about getting weird, because it made me think about you had your conversation with Hart, and you're talking about like so levitating the Pentagon is it should be on the table, right? It's because like, yeah, we don't know. We need to be willing to try things that aren't right, you know, quote unquote right per the activist playbook, because then we just hit up against the wall. So yeah, I love that you brought it there, and I'll let you say if you want to say anything, last word.
Yeah, I would just say that the limits of most people's imagination in that case are violence, which is, again, mostly what is determined to be violent or not violent is framed by the state. And there are certain things which are obviously violent harm to other people, but like, if the limit of your imagination is, well, none of our mediation processes are working, we're going to have to use violence, then what do you got after that? I mean, it just seems like there's a wall that's been hit, and we don't need everybody thinking past that wall, but there should be some of us discussing it, and there should be some way of communicating what's being discussed with the people that are hitting the wall without condemnation on either side, but actually a kind of openness to try to make sure that wall isn't there necessary, that, you know, that tactic, that limit is actually not the one that's reached for, and certainly not the one that's brought forward into a new politic.
There's another way around the wall, I guess. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. And we didn't solve all the problems or get to half of the things I could think about talking about with you, but I really appreciate the conversation and thinking with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Any chance to talk with you, I love talking with you. So thank you. And thanks everybody for going on the wild ride with us. And I hope you give me a break in the way that we're talking about giving other people a break and letting them off the hook.
Yeah, we're just trying things out.